come to a recapitulation of last week in a moment. But I want to begin directly. Why censor? Why begin with censor? There is a problem with sense certainty, a problem that is more radical than with any other form of consciousness. Every form of consciousness we're going to look at is internally complex. And it's in virtue of that internal complexity that we're going to be able to find difficulties and contradictions and the like. Sense certainty wants to be the immediacy of pure determinate knowing. So sense certainty wants to claim that it lacks internal complexity. And I take it our initial problem is to how to understand this claim of lacking internal complexity. How it is we begin here, why we should begin here rather than anywhere else. I take it for granted that since the introduction set up the issue of modern philosophy in terms of epistemology, that the entire section on consciousness is about epistemology. So consciousness here means epistemology as first philosophy. That's what the section is about. And furthermore, I take it that all the forms of consciousness we're going to look at are realist in the sense that ultimately, this is what I'll understand by realism, there is some ultimate fact of the matter which makes a claim true. That facts are exactly the sorts of things that make statements or sentences true. And that's what realism ultimately means. The proper definition of realism, as Hegel understands it, is there is some ultimate fact of the matter that is a truth maker. And that thought that there is ultimate fact of the matter that makes statements true is originally stated, just seems patently true, right? Snow is white because snow is white, right? The snow's being white is what makes the sentence true, right? But yet, the more you think about the idea of truth making, the more puzzling it's going to get. And in a way, all of consciousness is about that puzzle, that anything might be a truth maker in a naive sense. Sense certainty is a particularly intriguing form of that thesis. And its intrigue is the same, by the way, as the intrigue of high romanticism. That is the intrigue of immediacy. Read Jeffrey Hartman's first book. What's the name of that first book?
I was putting it on the spot. It's about romantics in the time.
I don't know if it does.
So, does it? On Shelley, and I know the one you're talking about, but I can't remember.
Yeah. All right, it will come back to me. Anyway. Sorry. This idea of immediacy. What do you think?
It's a Wordsworth.
No, there's one before the Wordsworth book.
And
Anyway, okay. Those of us who think we know something, we'll come out. But anyway, the notion of immediacy is one of those great human temptations that occurs in varieties of form. That's why I mentioned the Wordsworth and the romantic ideal. It goes right into 20th century romantic poets, including Rilke. Right? I can't remember what was the last chapter. That's what I was thinking. Maybe it's not. Okay. So we have to figure out what's going on with this claim to immediacy. And at least I want to understand it as it occurs here as an epistemological thesis, or an epistemological claim, which is to say, this is one place where Harris goes just wrong, it seems to me. He talks about a Frau, someone in her garden, I don't think that sense certainty is a common sense view at all. I think it's a highly constructive view, and I want to understand its construction and therefore why we're starting with it. If anything deserves to be called the common sense view of perception, I think it's a chapter on perception itself. Sense certainty, I want to argue, has to be understood as a self-conscious withdrawal from the turmoil of perceptual life. That what distinguishes sense certainty is that it expresses the desire for knowledge to escape all conditions. So rather than think of immediacy as immediate, that's I'm thinking the wrong view, I'm suggesting that immediacy is itself an expression of a desire to escape from conditionness. Mediation. It wants to escape from the burden that we have to tell the difference between true and false, and that indeed, in knowledge, we are responsible in some way for truth-telling and therefore distinguishing true from false. It is therefore not an accident, just to give some evidence for this, what seems like already a too strong a thesis, it's not an accident that in the chapter on perception, the issue for perception is how to make sure that falsity lies in the subject. That is, the job, that the whole chapter works by consciousness showing that it is responsible for falsity. And indeed, Hegel even uses the expression responsibility in paragraph 118. So he says there, toward the middle of the paragraph, in which what's happening at this point, which we'll get to, is that there's a growing need for a certain kind of reflection. After all, the subtitle of the perception chapter is the thing and deception. Deception is going to be located in the subject. And therefore, he says there that this return of consciousness into itself, which is directly mingled with pure apprehension of the object, for this return into itself has shown itself to be essential to perception, alters the truth. Consciousness at once recognizes this aspect as its own and takes responsibility for it. So even in perception, although perception is going to be naive in its own way, it takes responsibility for telling the difference between true and false and sorting things out. It has a moment of reflection. Sense certainty wants to deny there's an issue of responsibility. Wants to deny there's an issue of reflection, wants to escape from all of that. In other words, the immediacy of sense certainty is a fantasy of knowledge that arises from the discovery that knowledge is fragile and problematic and susceptible to skeptical undermining. Remember that it's the fear of error is the fear of truth. This is the deepest expression of the fear of error. This is it in a nutshell. Right? We want to, as it were, make error impossible. Right? And therefore, it shows that error is everywhere here, conditioning the possibility of this form of consciousness. So what sense certainty expresses is an awareness of knowledge as problematic, and it's the attempt to escape that problematic character. And remember that this is, for me, methodological in a sense, that for me, all of philosophy concerns temptations to see the world in various ways, and that therefore every form of consciousness has about it something of a structure of a fantasy of a certain kind. And when we're interrogating forms of consciousness, we're also interrogating fantasies about our being in the world and what makes that being in the world coherent. The fantasy here is one of absolute security, of course, an odd kind, namely absolute epistemic security. But absolute epistemic security should not be thought of as a dry philosopher's something, because the presumption here is that we're related to the world by means of knowing or representing the world, and therefore the desire for certainty here is the desire to ground our relationship, our connectedness to the world, to give us a place in the world, and the greatest threat to that would be to discover that our presumptively uncircumventable perceptions of the world are nothing but a dream, nothing but a fantasy, nothing but a conceptual scheme, nothing but words getting in the way of ideas. One of Locke's anxieties. Now, this fantasy of absolute security has, let's say, a logical character to it. It's nothing to make fantasies and logic separate. And the logic is one of defining the position by a series of negations. Roughly, what sense certainty does is negate anything that might count as a form of mediation, as something that might step between me and the world, and claim that they play no part in my contact with the world. So the contention is that all mediations are that could be relevant, play no role. And it follows from that that sense certainty is a derived position that emerges out of the quagmire of epistemological reflection.
its privilege here, therefore, is neither epistemological or logical or historical. It's not logically the most primitive thing. There is no such logically primitive thing. It's certainly not historically first. And epistemology need not bind itself, obviously, to sense certainty. I'm going to go on to other positions. Rather, its primacy is itself phenomenological. That is, it's the simplest expression of the anxiety that defines epistemology as first philosophy. So you can only have sense certainty as first once you had an overview of what epistemology looked like and then put its various possible instructions into some phenomenological order, roughly from most simple to most complex, where it turns out that complexity will not only be mediation, but the role of the mind in those acts of knowing, how much space is given to mental, the mind determining the world. It is important for all the views of consciousness in various ways that they want determinacy without mental determination. That is, it's not the mind that's going to give determinacy to the object via concepts, via language, by attention, I mean all the various ways in which we now have come to think that the mind does determine. And this is the most extreme form, the phenomenologically simplest form of that determinacy without determination. So sense certainty thinks it is without structure. And therefore it is Hegel, in a certain way, that imposes a structure on it. Namely, the structure that he's already given us in the introduction. That is, as a form of knowing and in itself, he's going to say it has that logical form despite itself, and therefore he is saying things of it that it would never admit sustaining itself. Now, it is just this fact that led Feuerbach to say that Hegel was wrong, that Hegel was imposing a structure on sense certainty, that Hegel was making sense certainty write things on the board and making sense certainty speak, and that all the sense certain subject had to do is not respond. Now, in a certain way, because this is a phenomenological analysis, then Hegel is kind of counting on the form of consciousness as responding and acting out and performing, and therefore the Feuerbachian refusal, assumption, I just know I'm immediately aware of this, has a kind of force against Hegel.
I do not think, some of my friends do, but I do not think there is a direct Hegelian answer to Feuerbach. That doesn't mean that Feuerbach is right. Feuerbach is completely wrong. But the reason he's wrong, the argument against Feuerbach, is to be found in Kant, who demonstrates that intuitions without concepts are blind. Hegel, in this case, would have to rely on the Kantian refutation, which is to say, I want to be kind of open about this, not every argument is refutable from one perspective. That Hegel has to count on, is counting on in this book, sub-Hegelian views as being themselves refuted by pre-Hegelian philosophers. Which is to say, and that's got to be true, that's what makes philosophy really historical. It's really historical. Now, of course, we, in going through the analysis of sense certainty, will have our own reasons to come to think that Feuerbach and sense certainty are false. But logically, those reasons, as it were, are question-making, right? Because what they presuppose our methodology. And our methodology, and this is the kind of point I've been trying to get to, our methodology, again, is Kantian. That is, our methodology presupposes the standpoint of self-consciousness. This, by the way, is noticeably called consciousness, not self-consciousness. So Hegel is claiming, in a way, in opposition to Kant, as we'll see more next week, that epistemology itself doesn't belong to self-consciousness, that all of epistemology is a matter of consciousness, namely mirroring or representing the world, and that self-consciousness, we already know, right, is a determining of, again, of a concept, of an object, and a knowing in relationship to it, right? That famous sentence, self-conscious determines the object, separates itself from it, gives it as an in itself, and has an experience of itself as knowing. Right? That's the structure of our method, again. So everything in this chapter falls below the level of our methodology. That is, in some phenomenological, theoretical way, the positions we're looking at are ones that would not acknowledge this structure. And therefore, in using this structure to analyze them, the argument could be made that Hegel's argument is circular or question-making. And you will see as you read through the analyses of all of the first three chapters that there's some anxiety by the commentators. You know, that, well, maybe this argument is question-making, maybe it's circular. Of course, I've already said that we don't have a presuppositionalist starting point. I've agreed it's historical. I've suggested that this whole analysis is from the perspective of we Kantians. So I'm not actually upset by that. But I do have to say something about what it means for our understanding
of the question of the status of consciousness. And my thought is this, that Hegel begins with consciousness because he wants to, and this is the clear project of the opening chapters, to overcome epistemology itself. So epistemology is going to be actually disposed of by the end of this chapter. Right? Everything that we call modern philosophy, done in the first three chapters. Gives us another 500 pages. That only when we reach self-consciousness do we reach a position that is at least structurally at a level with our own methodological starting point. So the hypothesis that I am operating with is that because consciousness is at a phenomenologically lower level than the methodology employed to refute it, then we must read this portion of the text as a genealogy. Namely, as a genealogy of self-consciousness. That is, he's going to try to trace a path, phenomenological path, of which the chapter on self-consciousness, the famous master-slave dialectic, will get us up to the level of our methodological starting point. And therefore, he wants, and the reason for doing this, therefore, the stakes of this, and I'll say a lot more about this next week, where, by the way, you should all be Force and Understanding for next week. You will certainly get to it. The stakes of it is to redefine the meaning of self-consciousness itself. And what I mean by that is quite simple. You will discover that the chapter of Force and Understanding is a sophisticated account of a form of scientific realism. Complicated, but virtually some form of scientific realism. In short, it's a sophisticated view of what a scientific reading of reading Kant as someone who believed in science, a sophisticated reading of Kantianism, at least the first critique, as a doctrine of science. And by putting that sophisticated view of science in a chapter called Consciousness, he is going to be claiming, therefore, that that form of knowing, A, does not belong to self-consciousness, and that self-consciousness, when we come to it, is really going to be a form of practical reason. So what this opening section is about, epistemology, is, we might say, the primacy of theoretical reason over practical reason. You may have already got that from the end of the chapter on sense certainty. That may be already obvious. But also is to say that self-consciousness, when understood properly, really cannot be understood in terms of the Copernican term. If the Copernican turn is understood as fundamentally an epistemological position, that self-consciousness, and why? Because the principle behind this is that every form of consciousness is self-determining. It determines a concept of an object and a conception of knowing. But if it's self-determining, if that's what self-consciousness really is, a form of self-determination, then self-consciousness is really about freedom. Right? So the argument that's going to get us from consciousness to self-consciousness is going to be, and this, by the way, for those who are interested, is also the structure of the logic, no determinacy, no determination of the object world without self-determining subjectivity, and therefore without free or autonomous subjects, whatever Hegel's going to mean by free or autonomous subjects. So, the elaborate beginning, when I say it's a genealogy, I mean it has to, as it were, find the resources within epistemology, which again is where the introduction started, using its new methodology to recover the possibility of that standpoint. Therefore, at that level, you might say that all of consciousness is question-making, not just the chapter on sense certainty. And that is inevitable given the nature of the methodology. So, we're starting somewhere in order to, as it were, find our beginning. So we're beginning before the beginning, and there'll be a sense, and Hegel makes it explicit, that when we get to self-consciousness, we're, as it were, beginning again. There's going to be even a weirder sense when we get to spirit. Again. There's a lot of beginnings here, and that's because beginning, as I keep saying, is immensely difficult. Why? Because we're always trying to abstract ourselves from the reality of our situation and make our abstract self-conception sufficient for our being in the world. And that we always have to recover even the possibilities of us undergoing the activity we're undergoing. So as I said, it will take again the whole book in order to get, in a way, to the beginning, to the possibility of writing. So this is simply an extreme form of what goes on throughout the whole book, which also means, should I tell you this? Yeah, I'll tell you, but you'll hate me for it. This isn't his real methodology. It changes when we get past self-consciousness, as it must. It kind of works for reason, but something totally different happens in spirit. If I may put it this way, in spirit, the methodology begins to look an awful lot like the causality of fate. But I'll come to that in about 15, 16 weeks. Okay, let me take a deep breath. We haven't even started sense certainty yet. I told you it wasn't easy to begin. Is there any questions about why there's a problem here? and how I'm suggesting we think about where we are in relationship to that problem. I can see puzzled looks. Just keep in mind, then, as in a nutshell, the methodology we're using to analyze sense certainty is more logically sophisticated than the position it's analyzing, and therefore is question-begging against it. We have to understand how we're entitled to do that. And I've said we're entitled to do that because this is not a presuppositionless analysis. There's a sense of, the analysis is not for the sake of starting from the real beginning. The sense, again, is to ask the question, who are we? That's the question of the book. Who are we? By which I mean, what does it mean to be we Kantians? So, Hegel's assuming that we Kantians, let's say we knowers, are unknown to ourselves, to quote somebody. We have to get behind our own prejudices. Yeah?
I have a question about anxiety. I'll try like this. I see that on the one hand, there's the anxiety that, if you like, is internal, this uncertainty itself, which is what you're talking about 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And then there's the anxiety, I guess, also at the level of the methodology that seeks to investigate this uncertainty as its object. It's part of the two voices that you were talking about at the end of class last time. And so my question has to do with the way in which self-certainty works in relationship to an anxiety that is perhaps insuperable for it. At the methodological level and also at the level of its various stages.
Sense-certainty is the personification of the anxiety, right? It is, on my analysis, simply the way of saying that that anxiety is intolerable and therefore must be escaped from. And that we are going to try to phenomenologically look at what happens when you try to escape from your responsibilities as an knower, namely your conditionedness. The voice of the we in this chapter, as you may have noticed, is slightly hectoring. Right? And it's hectoring because it doesn't really take this stuff too seriously. After all, intuitions about concepts are blind. And therefore, it really is there less for the sake of dealing with those anxieties. After all, the crack about the animals at the end, the joke, right, is a way of saying to sense certainty, get a life. Stop standing there and looking at the world and do something, right? So it sees sense certainty as a form that's going to occur in a lot of other forms that are going to be much more interesting, the most interesting version of which is the beautiful soul. The Hertelinian version. And the description of the beautiful soul is going to be interesting. That is what it is to escape, to try to escape conditionness and complexity. Only in that case, it's going to be moral complexity. So, and that's the other thing worth saying, although we're going to get rid of sense certainty as a naive epistemological position, the fantasies motoring it are going to recur at higher and higher levels. And that's one of the ways in which you will see that this book is also a palimpsest. That forms of consciousness that when you begin to see them, you're going to see that later ones have, as it were, as part of their logical infrastructure, earlier ones now worked up in a new way.
That's what I meant by the insuperability of anxiety. That's the problem.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's going to carry on. So this is not the end of sense certainty, only the end of epistemology. The anxiety will continue. Lexi?
So, when I was reading the certainty, the two things that bumped up in my mind were a certain logical notion. So the vista now, logically proper names in the Russellian sense.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you seem to have, or whether I read this way, competing logical views, the one of knowing concept of knowledge, and then sort of
right.
Itself is.
Absolutely.
And it struck me that one of the things that Hegel was trying to do was show that sort of that Russellian view of a pure existence
yep.
that I'm in contact with actually presupposes a more sophisticated view.
Yep.
But I'm not entirely sure why that would be question begging to say, look, this alternate model.
Because of paragraph 92. That sounds cheap. But it's because of the way he sets it up. Paragraph 92, by the way, paragraph 92 gets rid of the idea that this is Frau Smith or whoever she is. Because what when he says an actual sense certainty is not merely pure immediacy, but an instance of it, he means sense certainty as epistemological thesis. The reason, so that the notion of example here, and Harris, he was probably right, is probably poking fun at Jacobi, who was a defender of sense certainty, and he's probably saying, look, you can't have sense certainty as an epistemological thesis, because any actual, if you do that, then any actual sense certainty becomes an example of a universal. So be careful how you yourself operate. But then he, you know, lets Jacobi off the hook there. And he says, when we reflect on this difference, who this is, we find that neither one nor the other is only immediately present in sense certainty, but each is at the same time mediated. I have this certainty through something else, namely the thing, and it similarly is in sense certainty through something else, namely through the eye. So he's starting right out by saying that the very construction of sense certainty that we're now going to examine presupposes this logical structure. And then he says, just to deepen it, so this is what I meant by the complexity, and then in paragraph 93 he says, it's not only we who set it up this way, sense certainty cannot help but do this itself. So he says, literally, it is not just we who make this distinction between essence and instance, but sense certainty is going to have to do the same thing as well. So it's going to start by saying that this is the essence, and the sense awareness is inessential, and then it's going to switch. If the I, the essence, the being certain, and the object inessential, and then it's going to, right? So he's setting up a structure that is already in all of this. So that's why I'm saying that he's kind of pushing sense certainty in a way that it would not acknowledge, right? Yeah.
Well, I think what you're saying is true, but I mean, he does have some other formulations where he seems to pour a little bit of cold water over. At the end of paragraph 93, when he's characterizing the object as an immediacy, he says it is whether it is known or not.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds to me like a perfectly
realist characterization of what people who hold this position are after. I mean, it's not stated in Hegelese with mediacy and immediacy. So couldn't Hegel claim that he's not question-making, he's merely translating what they mean? I mean, you know, and of course then it's going to be a question whether it's a good translation. But, I mean, realists do make that claim, right? That an object's going to be there whether I know it or not. And that doesn't fit into that structure.
Oh, yes, it does.
Well,
it
does. It's going to have to.
No, it does here because, and here's the point, because the only way in which, so when we say essence here, you know, equals, you know, it is, right? And hence why, if you're interested, why this chapter correlates quite well with the opening chapter of the Logic on Being. The only reason that when this turns out to run into problems, we go to the I side, is because the I side was there all along, right? And it's that I'm claiming, that is, the mediated character of the various moments into essential and inessential is exactly what deprives the position of the purity or immediacy it wants for itself. Right? That's the fault. Okay. So we haven't started yet. So as I said, this turns out to be a little bit more complicated than it first appears. Okay, let's see if we can get started with a little bit of an analysis. How much more? Are you all kind of clear about how this also connects to the idea of providing foundations for knowledge? Are you all... Never. Okay, let me just say a few words again to set it up, and then we'll have a break and we'll come back and start going right through the analysis quickly. So just a few more words of setting the thing up. Again, this is part of a representational understanding of knowledge, and that the trick of this particular formulation, what I think makes it particularly interesting, is that the project of sense certainty is to collapse the object of knowledge into the sensory state in which it is apprehended, such that the distinction between fact and knowing collapses. Right? This is why I'm saying that the mediation is a problem. That this thing only works, I mean, after all, what all of this depends on is there's an epistemic state of being aware and a separate thing of which you are aware, which you distinguish yourself from and relate yourself to. Right? Now, sense certainty is not going to be able to... It's going to be able to do that if it allows that complexity. So what it wants to do is have the notion of epistemic state and the notion of awareness collapse into one another. Right? And it's going to have different versions now, the object version and the state version, of that collapse of fact and state. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say is that this move is also supposed to answer the question of which every epistemologist wants the answer to, how do I know that my awareness is really an awareness of it? That is, that it's not an illusion, you know, that I'm not cut off from the world. And the thought here is I have to somehow get outside all the various things that cut me off from the world, namely language, conceptualization, prejudices, and the like, and what do I want to say? Open my eyes, ears, and fingers to the world, so that the model here, I think, is not, in fact, perception. I think the model here is touching. I think what sense certainty wants is the touch of the world. And we know, and now this meant to kind of underline this idea of the collapse of fact and knowledge, we know from Merleau-Ponty, and then from nearly everyone else, that there's something really queer about touching, namely that when I touch the table, I can either have it as feeling the table pressing on my finger, or feeling my finger pressing on the table. That there is this, right, doubleness, touching touch, that is involved in touching, that doesn't seem to be the case in any other of the modalities. Right? There's something about that. And the thought here is that if perception were perception, were the touch of the world, perception were the touch of the world, then I would have shot right through all my language, all my preconceptions, and I could then begin, and this is the thought that all this been, I would have foundations for my knowledge, this. And then I can erect everything on top of these absolutely certain foundations. And they're certain because, right, they are just immediate, etc., etc. So sense certainty is this attempt. So immediacy is also the thought that knowledge has foundations, and the foundations are immediate awareness of the things of the world. And that the edifice of knowledge is going to be built on it. Okay. Maybe that's a good place to stop since we haven't started yet. Have a deep breath, have a little break, and when we come back, we'll just go right into the text.